Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. You could get burned by this information. NASA reports ozone destruction is occurring much faster than previously thought. That story this time. Also, more on the nation's energy policy. And a visit with wilderness pioneer Keith Nitre, returning from an historic trek across the Brooks Range in Alaska. He tells of one exhilarating experience he had on the Arctic Wildlife Refuge.
There are 180,000 caribou migrating annually north through south, and I just walked through a small subgroup of about 10,000 for a full day as they were migrating down a valley, and I was migrating up, and they literally had to flow around me, and I felt like I was a human rock in a river of caribou, and it's a tremendous experience, and the caribou herd itself is a tremendous resource.
That story and more this time on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a national production of WAMC. It's made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. For a number of years now, we have been following science reports concerning ozone depletion over the South and North Poles. One phenomenon, the ozone hole over Antarctica, raises serious questions about what is going on in the upper-level atmosphere as a result of various forms of pollution here on the surface below. Well, now, according to latest findings from NASA, not only has the breakdown of ozone begun to appear elsewhere around the globe, it is doing so at faster and faster rates. In fact, the rate of breakdown caused Environmental Protection Agency Administrator William Riley to say it was stunning information. Dr. Richard McPeters is chairman of the ozone processing team at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. It was his team that made the startling discoveries using the TOMS, or Total Ozone Mapping Spectrometer, aboard a satellite circling the Earth since November of 1978.
We recently recalibrated the instrument because we found that while in space, the instrument actually had degraded and was causing us to get incorrect ozone values. In last summer, we finished a recalibration of the instrument so that we now have data that we trust over a period of almost 12 years now. And last fall at the San Francisco American Geophysical Union meeting, we presented the initial results on the global changes in ozone that we were seeing. What we're finding are two things. First, at the equator, nothing is happening. The ozone is very stable. It's just about the same now that it was in 1978. But when we look at the higher latitudes, both north and south, we've seen some really significant decreases in ozone. When Mr. Riley issued his statement, he was referring to the fact that at the latitude at which we live, about 40 degrees north, we have seen almost a 6% decrease in ozone over the last 10 years. The significance of this is that it's at least twice as big as anybody had expected, based on the best models that we have that include the effects of the chlorine, the chlorofluorocarbons.
McPeters says it is still too early to say exactly why this is happening, but preliminary analyses point to upper-level atmospheric activity over the North Pole.
The Antarctic ozone hole effect requires some very unusual conditions. You have to have polar night. You have to have extremely cold temperatures that lead to the formation of the very tiny ice crystals up at the 15-mile altitude where you have the ozone layer. And that's why you only see these effects in the Antarctic ozone hole. Now, in 1989, aircraft missions were flown into the Arctic, and they found exactly the same conditions there. But instead of forming into a true ozone hole, the weather is so much more disturbed in the northern hemisphere that it never had a chance to form. What we think is happening is that these local areas of low temperatures and the ice crystals almost act like a Cousinard or something that sits there eating the ozone locally. And then this ozone poor air mixes into the rest of the hemisphere, and that decreases the level overall.
The White House has criticized the report, saying, as we have just heard McPeters recount, the latest data was collected using recalibrated instruments. In other words, our earlier data was more primitive and thus likely less accurate than what we have now. McPeters, while noting the rate of destruction has increased, offers this observation.
This almost certainly is not the end of the world, that these processes do tend to be somewhat self-limiting. There's only so far that the destruction can go. There's only so long a period in which you have these extremely cold temperatures. So I wouldn't expect that that all the ozone is going to be destroyed or anything.
However, there is an obvious question that rises from this discovery.
When we first started seeing this result last fall, we were saying this is really big. It is alarming in the sense that if we have underestimated it at this point, and if it keeps getting bigger, then you have to wonder just how big the depletion can be and whether or not the protocols that have been signed to date to control the fluorocarbons are being enacted quickly enough.
Dr. Richard McPeters, director of the ozone processing team at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, he says this August, NASA will be sending up another set of ozone monitoring instruments aboard a Soviet spacecraft. This is Bruce Robertson. According to figures supplied by the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, if every household in the United States that uses one had the most efficient refrigerator available right now, the electricity saved would eliminate the need for about 10 large power plants. On the other hand, according to statistics listed in the official National Energy Strategy released by President Bush in late February, the nation will need up to 275 gigawatts, that's 275 billion watts, of additional generating capacity by the year 2010. Which of these two projections holds depends on a combination of factors: how much we are willing and able to implement conservation measures, and how much we are willing to live with the additional costs of maintaining the status quo. Opponents of the president's plan say it will not fly unless it contains more support for conservation and alternative energies. Supporters of the White House plan say we cannot hope to move into the future without continued reliance on the sources we have come to know so well: oil, coal, natural gas, and nuclear. Philip Bain has recently been installed as the new president and chief executive officer of the U.S. Council for Energy Awareness. The CEA is a trade group for the nation's nuclear power industry. A major chapter in the National Energy Strategy is devoted to detailed plans to revitalize the nation's nuclear power industry. Bain, understandably, is very pleased by the president's plan.
His energy policy, I think, is essential to the country, primarily because I think an assured supply of electrical energy is essential to the financial health of the United States. And if we're going to continue to grow as we have in the past, I don't know whether you're aware of it, but our gross national product has tracked very well the use of electricity in this country for a number of years now. So I think we need to have an assured supply of electricity for our entrepreneurs in the United States to be willing to invest their money in the infrastructure necessary to keep our economy growing.
We can still provide for economic growth, but do so for a longer period if we make our energy plans based on sustainability, says John Morrill of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy.
An energy efficient economy provides all of the goods and services that we now have, or improvements in those goods and services, using less energy to provide those goods and services. So as we see an energy efficient economy, it involves no drastic changes in human behavior. It does not involve sacrifices by people. Rather, it's a matter of choosing efficient technologies and using advances that are happening in the laboratory in everyday life.
Morrow says the president's plan addresses only the short-term solutions.
We're quite disappointed by the strategy that has been announced, which relies on increasing production rather than using what we have more efficiently. And we have done analyses that show that by improved energy efficiency in terms of more efficient automobiles and more efficient buildings, we can actually save quite a bit more oil than is likely to be found in these offshore or polar oil exploration projects.
Can you tell us a little more how you would implement an energy-efficient economy, and speak about that specifically as in opposition to the president's plan? What specifically would you replace or change about his plan to guide the nation into energy efficiency?
Well, there are a number of market incentives and regulatory measures that can be taken to improve energy efficiency. We advocate strong yet cost-effective efficiency standards on new cars and trucks, lighting equipment, electric motors, and other equipment. These regulations will not hurt consumers or end users because they are cost effective. In other words, if a more efficient motor costs a building manager $20 more to buy than the cheapest model available, but if it saves him $20 a year in electricity, that's a good buy and that's a good regulation to have around. The same principle holds for what we're calling for on new cars and light trucks and lighting equipment.
Right now, about 20% of the nation's electrical generating capacity is provided by nuclear power. This is second only to coal. What is more, assert its proponents, nuclear fission emits no sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, or other greenhouse gases. Yet safety concerns have forced the cancellation of more than 100 new nuclear power stations since the early 1970s. Bain says the public should pay attention to the new, improved nuclear industry. From the crisis at Three Mile Island, we have learned much.
The TMI accident itself proved that the design was built so that it could withstand a problem and still not harm the public. And then, of course, the vendors who design and build reactors took the lessons learned from TMI and have designed a whole new family of reactor plants, which are simpler, require less operator action to maintain themselves in a safe condition, and are able to be built cheaper on a tighter schedule. And I think the vendors have positioned themselves well to have products there when someone wants to invest in a new nuclear power plant.
Bain sees a composite picture of the nation's energy solution, one that does not include much oil or natural gas.
I don't think that even if we do all of the conservation that we're able to do, I think there will still be a need for the building of baseload generating plants. And I think that nuclear power will be one of the means that we need to use. I think if we can develop renewable energy sources, we ought to use those also. I don't think that oil will play a major part because, as you've seen from the Gulf War, it's a very unstable fuel supply, and I don't foresee anyone trying to build another oil plant. Gas, I think, would be beneficial, but you know, we have about 60 years worth of gas left in this country, and as it goes, you know, as it gets closer and closer to the end of the supply, the price is bound to go up, as I see it.
One of the barriers to energy efficiency, says John Morrell, is what we perceive it to be, perceptions that he works to dispel.
We don't like to tell people that energy conservation means putting on a sweater and turning down the thermostat, because there is energy-efficient technology out there that can provide you with the same level of comfort just at a lower energy cost and dollar cost. think about how you're using energy, and try to get information from local or state sources, and even your utility. Utilities have become much more interested again in energy efficiency in a serious way.
We've been talking with John Morrill of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy and Philip Bain, recently named President of the U.S. Council for Energy Awareness. This is Bruce Robertson. It is not often anymore that we have a chance to go where no one has gone before. It is also not often anymore that what we do makes a really big difference. Keith Nitre has achieved both. Nitre recently completed the first ever trek across the length of the Brooks Range in northern Alaska, and he has seen firsthand the wilderness of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, this at a time when that area is coming under intense scrutiny by Congress considering energy legislation and the oil reserves believed to be locked beneath the tundra in that area. Nitre, who homesteads on 40 acres of wilderness terrain in southern Alaska, set out on the hike in March of 1989, arriving on the coast of the Bering Sea in early 1990. Carrying with him a 115-pound backpack loaded with clothes, food, first aid equipment, a camera, and an axe, he encountered intense weather conditions ranging to 110 degrees below zero. Though he has lived alone in the wilderness for the past 12 years, he says he felt challenged to make this trek. He joins us now. The first question I have that comes to my mind is, why would you do something like this?
Well, mostly to take a step away from the man-made world and get it back out into the elements and get a first-hand understanding of the psychological as well as physical separation from this 20th century. I did it because it was a dream to cross Alaska. It's many people's dreams up there. But the Brooks Range is a formidable range, but it's also a beautiful arc. And I'd never been in that region. I thought, well, if I'm going to go up, I might as well see the whole dang thing.
You traveled by yourself?
For the most part, yeah. I have a companion of a wolf hybrid, so I'm not entirely crazy. I can talk to someone and relate to an animal. But in as far as with other humans, for the most part, I travel alone. It's safer that way.
How many miles would you travel on a given day if the weather was permitting and the like?
A good average for me nowadays is 12 miles a day, no matter what the terrain.
Now, would that have been 12 miles of really rigorous, fast hiking, or were you taking in the sights as you went along, so to speak?
Well, that's taking in the sights. I study nature. I look at the underlying patterns of nature wherever I go. That's the average. Some days I could go up to 22 if the ground was hard, and some days only 3 or 4, depending, and also depending if I'm doing any research along the way.
Keith, 12 miles a day by yourself, that gives you a lot of time to think.
In silence, one knows oneself, I'll tell you, and I've learned tremendous amounts about myself. I feel very calm inside, very centered from that experience.
Walking along a trail, hiking a mountain pass, going along a river, looking at the glaciers, what kinds of experiences did you have by yourself? You did encounter from time to time some native Alaskan villages, mm-hmm, and villagers,
yeah,
but for the most part you were by yourself. Tell of some particular experiences that you might have had with encountering the natural, the wildlife.
Well, one of the great experiences I had was walking with the porcupine caribou herd in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. There are 180,000 caribou migrating annually north through south, and I just walked through a small subgroup of about 10,000 for a full day as they were migrating down a valley, and I was migrating up, and they literally had to flow around me, and I felt like I was a human rock in a river of caribou, and it's a tremendous experience, and the caribou herd itself is a tremendous resource.
The Alaska Wildlife Refuge is one part of the Brooks Range, from the Brooks Range out to the coast. A lot of talk, a lot of attention being focused on this region because of its potential oil reserves beneath. Some are saying that it's a very stark and harsh region that really is nothing to write home about. You've looked at it yourself. Can you tell us a little bit about what is in and on the Alaska Wildlife Refuge?
Well, it's an immense biosphere. It's very fragile, and people mistake that for barren. There's, as I said, it supports 180,000 caribou, so it can't be that desolate. besides the muskox, the polar bears, the wolves that are up there, the tremendous bird populations, 80,000 snow geese stage out of that area. Since it is a fragile and also a stark environment as far as only tundra, not forests, it takes such a large area to support this wildlife. But there's a sense of space that we don't have down here, which is a resource in and of itself, elbow room. And the clean air that's up there, and just an overwhelming beauty. People used to say that the Grand Canyon looks stark and barren. It's just a canyon. And yet, what do we look at it now? You know, we wouldn't dam that up.
Can you give us a feeling of what it's like for you, having seen that area, to know that it is under scrutiny and that perhaps at some point oil rigs and roads and airports and towns and even cities would grow up supporting the oil drilling business and the oil transportation business in that area?
I know firsthand the environmental record of the oil consortium up there, and it's not very good, and so it's very sad for me to even think about that. Where they are now is bad enough, but to move into the heart of the calving grounds of this porcupine caribou herd would literally be destroying the biological or heart of that region. And it would affect vast areas well beyond where the drilling might occur. It's extremely sad for me to see this and how it would affect the natives as well. It totally destroyed their culture.
Nitre recounts how during a lengthy stay in one village, an elderly Native American told him that he has seen everything changing in recent years. The ice leaves the rivers earlier and earlier each spring, and the caribou, they're just milling around as though restless and anxious. Keith Nitre works also at the Alaska Center for the Environment in Anchorage. He says he earns money to lay in food stores not only by leading hiking tours. Each year it is he who makes and clears the Iditarod Trail. This is Bruce Robertson. With the passage of the Clean Air Bill late last year, which the president signed, and now with new questions and concerns about the nation's energy supply for the future, many are looking for a way to achieve both clean air and a sustainable fuel supply. In a radio commentary prepared for the Environment Show, Larry J. Wilson, director of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, says he has some advice.
Iowa has something to offer to a nation seeking pollution solutions. Our vast acres of cornfields are the source of ethanol, a renewable fuel. We've been using ethanol as a fuel additive in Iowa for more than 12 years. With the passage of the Clean Air Act amendments last October, more areas of the country will soon be using ethanol blends. Ethanol cuts down on the ozone and carbon monoxide emissions that turn into smog in our major cities. Ethanol use in place of fossil fuels also reduces greenhouse gases, most importantly, carbon dioxide. The greenhouse effect, which some scientists believe will lead to global climate change, is essentially the carbon cycle gone out of balance. We're putting too much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for the natural process to absorb. The corn plants from which ethanol is produced take up carbon dioxide while they are growing, keeping the carbon cycle in better balance. Every major auto manufacturer that sells cars in the United States permits the use of ethanol blends. Some manufacturers have gone a step farther and are encouraging the use of ethanol as a clean air fuel. At any rate, any questions about vehicle performance on 10% ethanol blends have been resolved in ethanol's favor.
Larry Wilson, director of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, speaking to us from Des Moines. His comments are part of a series of essays heard from time to time on the Environment Show. And finally today, citizens in western Colorado have been trying for years to get a major polluter to reduce its emissions and comply with state and federal regulations that do exist. As Becky Rumsey reports, there may be a light at the end of the tunnel.
The Louisiana Pacific Corporation calls it oriented structural board. To others, it's wafer or chipboard. It's made from trees like aspen that are smaller and faster growing than northwestern cedar and Douglas fir, and it's cheaper than plywood. But wafer board plants near Kremling in Montrose, Colorado, emit smoke and toxic gases like phenol, formaldehyde, and MDI. For years, Louisiana Pacific has drawn fire from neighboring citizens. A case is pending in federal court in which plaintiffs claim health effects from living near the Montrose plant. Neighbors and regulators alike want LP to comply with state and federal laws.
Another year has gone by with Louisiana Pacific not getting its federal permit. It's a pretty basic problem. It's been going on for 7 years.
Mallory Clark is a member of Western Colorado Congress, a citizens' action group that's been pressuring the state to get tough with LP. Last year, the company entered into an agreement with the Colorado Department of Health. LP cut back on its wafer board production, its emissions, and paid an $80,000 fine. The company also agreed to complete applications for federal permits. The permit process means analyzing, then installing the most cost-effective pollution control technology, all subject to state review. This February, Louisiana Pacific completed the bulk of its permit applications.
I poured on his head 100-pound sack full of chip barchet.
You're listening to the Waferettes, the group sang at a rally in Montrose earlier this month when the Western Colorado Congress gave Louisiana Pacific a Diddle and Doddle Award for taking a year to apply for federal permits.
To go through a very complex regulatory process like this and have only 1 2-week hitch over the last year, I think is quite remarkable and quite commendable. I don't think that's diddling and dawdling.
Andrew Lowy is an attorney who represents LP. But it could be yet another year before LP actually installs wet electrostatic precipitators, the state's preferred pollution control. Regulators say the so-called wet ESPs should help reduce plant-produced smog in nearby towns and protect the vistas of two national parks and several wilderness areas.
There are a lot of chemicals, toxics, that we do not have direct authority to control. We just hope that they will be controlled in the process of controlling other pollutants.
That's Ron Rutherford, Chief of Air Compliance at the Environmental Protection Agency in Denver. According to Rutherford, the 1990 Clean Air Act boosts the number of EPA-regulated toxics from 8 to 189. Mallory Clark.
I think the Clean Air Act has some good protection in it, but it could be many years in implementation. The state of Colorado shouldn't be afraid of implementing its own regs in the meantime.
Once Louisiana Pacific gets its permits, it will be able to increase its wafer board production in Colorado again. In Montrose, Colorado, this is Becky Rumsey.
Becky Rumsey reports for the High Plains News Service, a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils, which is based in Billings, Montana. And that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed this edition of the Environment Show. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, feel free to drop us a line. Address your questions and comments to The Environment Show, WAMC, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York. The zip code is 12206. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. This has been a WAMC national production. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.